For at least 20 years, youth gangs had become a prominent and menacing way of life within parts of Manchester that had festered within the slums of places such as Hope Street, Greengate, Ardsall, Gorton, Angel Meadow and Ancoats, to name but a few. Young lads between the age of 14 and 18 found solace by joining gangs that gave them a feeling of importance. It also gave them the respect they felt they deserved, as well as a sense of belonging. And for many, it was a way out of the monotony of day-to-day life that offered them very little hope. With smart haircuts and their own unique dress code, which included bell-bottom trousers, silk scarves and brass-tip pointed clogs, they would roam the back streets and alleyways of Manchester in gangs that reflected the territories they were formed in. For example, the Bengal Tigers came from the streets around Bengal Street in Ancoats, Meadow Lads from Angel Meadow, and the Grey Mare Boys from the Grey Mare Lane in Bradford. And to coincide with this ever-increasing wave of gang violence, a name would emerge from the streets that would become synonymous with each gang, the Scuttlers. Fights would often be organised, it seems, beforehand, with gangs leaving messages with dates, times and venues written in chalk days in advance. They would meet in fields, crofts and vacant grounds in the densely populated areas of Manchester, as well as on the streets they had taken their names from. And as for the police, they had become powerless, it seems, to stem the tide of violence that was gripping the city. And when they did try to intervene, both rival gangs would, at times, break from fighting each other and join forces simply to attack the police who had come between them. Armed with various weapons such as broken bottles, stones and knives, it was without doubt that of a sharpened brass belt buckle that was the favoured weapon of most, and as ferocious turf wars were played out between rival gangs, their aim wasn't to murder one another, but to simply maim and disfigure. Of course, it goes without saying that there were some casualties during this reign of violence, but each gang would generally comply to an unwritten rule that murder was not part of scuttling. But on Sunday, April 17, 1892, a fight between two rival gangs would put into motion a series of events that would ultimately spiral out of hand, to the disgust and bewilderment of all scuttlers, as they would turn their backs on one of their own. The Bradford Street Scuttlers from Ancoats and the Lime Street Boys from Miles Platting had, for around 5 or 6 weeks, been at each other due to accusations being made by the Bradford Street gang, who had said that one of the Lime Street Boys, a boy by the name of Peter Kennedy, had banged or hit some of the Bradford Street girls. Mild skirmishes, threats and insults had been exchanged between the members of the two gangs over a period of months, but all this accumulated on April 17th when a full-scale fight erupted. Days after the scuttle, some members of both gangs began issuing tit-for-tat threats. On one side was Peter Kennedy, part of the Lime Street Boys gang, and on the opposite side were William, James Hands, Edward Fleming and Charles Davidson, who were all just 16 years old and all from the Bradford Street gang. Kennedy, who was just 16 years old, was part of a relatively large family, living with his parents, two brothers and two sisters in Addington Street, Oldham Road, which is situated within the Miles Platting area of Manchester. He was employed within the dye works in the Ancoats area, and it was here he was asked to join the Lime Street gang by several of his work colleagues. William Christopher Willen was the son of George and Hannah Willen. He had two brothers and three sisters, and together they lived at number 14 Canal Street, Ancoats. Now Kennedy, who, once his shift at work had finished at Crabtree's Dye Works, had the arduous task of trying to make his way home safely through the slum areas between the Rochdale and Ashton Canals, the home of the Bradford Street gang. This was no easy task, as Willen, along with his accomplices, would often wait in the shadows and on the street corners for their opportunity to target Kennedy, and on Thursday, April 21st, 1892, that is exactly what they did. At around 5:30 p.m, Kennedy would be stopped by the Bradford Street gang on Alum Street, with Willen asking him, "What of this scuttling?" To which Kennedy replied, "Well, we will talk about this scuttling when I have put two or three in the infirmary." Strangely, Kennedy was allowed to pass through, but this seemed to incense Willen. The following evening, Willen gathered up three of his friends, Hans, Fleming and Davidson, telling them to get some pop bottles and have a smack at Kennedy. However, it appears Kennedy had got wind of this planned attack on him. Rushing home via St. Thomas Street, he would make his way through the hostile territories that the Bradford Street gang roamed. Now, this would only infuriate Whelan even more, declaring he would dose or stab Kennedy the next day. On Saturday, 23rd of April, and at around 12:30, he had gathered several members of the Bradford Street gang, with all of them making their way towards the corner of Great and Court Street. And just like the previous evening, Kennedy had heard that Whelan and his gang would be waiting for him to pass by not too long after his shift had ended. This time he wouldn't try to dodge them, instead arranging for four of his friends to meet him at 1 o'clock outside the gates of the dye works he was employed at. And as they set off, Kennedy was eventually joined by just two of his workmates, Jimmy Cohen and John Carr. This would normally have given Kennedy the peace of mind of making his way through Ancourt safely, as Cohen was a member of the infamous Bengal Tigers, one of the Manchester's feared gangs at the time. At 1:30, Kennedy, Cohen and Carr were spotted in Mill Street, and as they turned the corner into Great Ancourt Street, they were immediately surrounded by William and his gang. "What's it to be?" asked Kennedy. William, who was holding an open clasp knife, replied, "Anything you like." His reply was like a signal for the Bradford Street gang to initiate the attack on Kennedy, Cohen and their four friends. As the fight broke out, it quickly escalated into an all-out battle. Kennedy, realising the situation he was in, began to run towards nearby Cannell Street. Making his way down the street, Whelan had quickly made ground on him, and in doing so plunged his knife deep into Kennedy's left side from behind. As Kennedy fell to the ground yelling out in pain, Whelan turned and made his way into Alum Street and eventually out of sight. Hearing Kennedy's cry for help, Carr rushed over to him, asking, "What is the matter?" In a serious amount of pain, Kennedy replied, "I'm stabbed." At this point, Kennedy, who was holding his hand to his side, would tell Carr he wasn't sure who had stabbed him. Helping him onto his feet, Kennedy, in a state of collapse, would make his way towards the Manchester Royal Infirmary, aided by Carr. And once there, and after being attended to, he would be detained until the police could arrive to interview him. Shortly after the attack on Kennedy, Whelan had made his way towards New Islington, and it is there he would meet up with James Hands. He was still carrying the knife, which was opened, the blade containing a large quantity of blood. "I have dosed him," said Whelan. Not exactly surprised by Whelan's admittance, Hands asked, "Who have you dosed?" "Kennedy," replied Whelan. Wanting to know more, Hands then asked, "Whereabouts have you dosed him? In the head?" William then began to rummage around in his pockets before pulling out an envelope containing his wages. "No, in the ribs," he replied whilst handing over the envelope. "Will you take my knife?" Hans didn't seem to hesitate, taking the knife off William and putting it into his pocket. "If you get copped, don't round on me," William then asked Hans. Both boys then separated, with each making their way to their homes. Hans would continue to look after the knife until the following Sunday, and for whatever reasoning, perhaps a guilty conscience, he would take it to the Cannell Street police station before handing it over to Inspector Bates. On Monday, 25th of April, Peter Kennedy, who had been treated by the doctors at the Manchester Infirmary but who was now in a critical condition, would be interviewed by the police. As for Whelan, he was taken into custody by Sergeant Whitehead, and in answer to the charge of stabbing, he simply said, "I did not do it. I received a knife from Edward Fleming, which I gave to James Hand in Cannell Street." Fleming himself would also be arrested later that same afternoon, and whilst denying the charge of stabbing, he did admit to the police that he had a stick at the time of the attack. On Tuesday, 26th of April, and before Mr. E.M. Henriques and Mr. Holt, William and Edward Fleming were charged with inflicting grievous bodily harm on Peter Kennedy by stabbing him with a knife. A large number of witnesses were called, whose evidence was enough to connect both William and Fleming with the charge aimed at them. Both boys would be remanded, with all witnesses being bound over to attend the next hearing. Just over a week later, and on Sunday, May the 8th, at around 8 p.m, Peter Kennedy would sadly pass away from his wounds due to an internal hemorrhage. And 2 days later, on Tuesday, May the 10th, the inquest into his death would take place at the City Coroner's Court, Minsall Street, with the Deputy City Coroner, Mr. Sidney Smelt, overseeing the case. By this time, Charles Davidson had also been arrested and charged with causing the death of Kennedy. Thomas Kennedy, father of Peter, would give evidence of identification of his son. James Hand would be the next to be questioned, and he would give an extremely detailed account as to the events that took place on Saturday, 23rd of April. He would go on to tell the court that he and his two companions would doze him, to which the coroner asked, "What do you mean by that?" Hans replied, "We meant to do him harm." Hans would also tell the court of how he came across Willen close to New Islington, who offered him his wages to take the knife. James Cohen was the next to take to the stand. He, just like James Hand, would go into detail as to what had occurred on that Saturday afternoon, telling the jury that he and Kennedy had been surrounded by Willen and his gang, and after that they had been separated, he heard Kennedy shout, "Oh!" Upon looking at where Kennedy had shouted from, he had seen Willen falling over but holding the knife. Charles Davidson, William Willen and Edward Fleming would all take to the stand to give their versions of the events that had taken place. Fleming would tell of how he had gone with Willen and Davidson into Great Ancourt Street for the sole purpose of seeing Kennedy to ask him to let the matter drop, meaning the fight with Willen. As for Willen, he would reaffirm what Fleming had indeed told the court, in that he had asked Kennedy to let the matter drop and let him, Fleming, get back to work. But he would also tell of how Kennedy had told his companions to lash out before running away. It was in the course of the running that he fell onto the ground with Willen falling on top of him. At the conclusion of Willen's statement, the court adjourned for lunch, but the coroner expressed his intention of having all three boys before him upon resumption later that afternoon. Dr. John William Smith would take to the stand after lunch, and he gave a statement telling of how he had attended to Kennedy at the Royal Infirmary, and at the close of his evidence, the case was adjourned until Thursday, 12th of May. The hearing on the 12th of May, evidence, just as what was brought up at the inquest on the 26th of April, would again be given, and Willen, Fleming and Davidson would be committed for trial at the Assizes on the charge of willful murder. At the Manchester Assizes on Friday, 20th of May 1892, and before Justice Collins, William Willen, Edward Fleming and Charles Davison were indicted for the murder of Peter Kennedy. All of the boys involved, including that of Kennedy, were just 16 years of age, as we have already mentioned at the start of this story. The evidence, as detailed by Mr. H.W. West, QC, would disclose a system of what was known as scuttling, or fights with deadly weapons between various factions in the lower districts of the city. In court, the knife used by Willen, as well as that of a stick used by Fleming, were both produced. The jury would also hear of how Willen, after stabbing Kennedy in the back, would later wipe the blood off the knife before handing it over to James Hans. Hans, when cross-examined by Mr. M. Keand, would tell of how he had known Willen and Fleming for around 8 months, and he had kept company with them for about two. Although he had never been engaged in any scuttling, nor had he ever been chased by any other gang members, he knew that by having a smack at Kennedy with pop bottles, this was a form of scuttling. He himself admitted that on the 21st of April, he had picked up a pop bottle and ran with the others, chasing Kennedy, but as Kennedy was too quick for them, they could not carry out their promise of attacking him. And he would also admit that it was his idea to meet again on Saturday, 23rd of April, with the view to meeting Kennedy again, but nothing was ever said about bringing a knife with them. Now, Hans would also tell the jury that he did indeed throw an old used broken pop bottle at Kennedy, and he realised that this could be well interpreted as being scuttling. As for the knife, he had handed over to Inspector Bates. Now, this had been purchased by Willen from another boy called Nags, and Hans would tell the jury that Willen had said that he would dose Kennedy. Hans believed that Willen intended to stab Kennedy, but did not say it was wrong to do so, although he thought at the time it was. Whilst in court, Hans explained that it was Edward Fleming's father, also called Edward, who had called at his home, and after finding out about the knife, he had asked Hans to give up the knife. Hans was afraid, thinking if he did so, it would be him who would be accused of stabbing Kennedy. Several other witnesses came forward, including that of George Willen, William's father. He would go on to say that his employer, John Whelan, gave William a good character. And at the close of the evidence, Mr. McKeon addressed the jury on behalf of Willen and Fleming. He would go on to say that if a person armed himself with a weapon and used it in such a manner as was likely to cause grievous bodily harm to another person, and death ensued, then it amounted to the crime of willful murder. But if, on the other hand, a person used a weapon, however lethal it might be, and used it in a passion, but did not intend, when using it, to do grievous bodily harm, and death resulted, then it only amounted to manslaughter, and that was the verdict he asked them to give against Willen. He would also tell the jury that Fleming should not be convicted of any wrongdoing. There was no evidence to show that Fleming, or indeed Charles Davidson, knew that Willen intended to use the knife on Kennedy. And whilst there had been, no doubt, a conspiracy to dose Kennedy, there was never at any point any murderous intent. Now, the judge in summing up said it seemed to be clear that the hand of Willen struck the blow which caused the death of Kennedy, and the crime would be one of murder or manslaughter according to the intent with which it was done. The jury retired to consider their verdicts at 3:20 p.m. and returned back into court at 4:35 p.m. In answer to the clerk of court, the foreman of the jury said, "We find William Willen guilty of willful murder, but strongly recommend him to mercy on account of his extreme youth. Fleming and Davidson we find not guilty." With this, the crowd watching from the gallery erupted into considerable excitement, and during this, the judge donned his black cap as he passed the sentence of death in the usual form. His lordship was repeatedly interrupted by Willen, who was terror-stricken. "Oh, Master, don't! Oh, have mercy, I'm only 16, he repeated over and over amid tears and crying. At one point, Willen became so frantic that two policemen in the dock had to seize him and hold him by the arms until the sentence was completed. He was then removed to the waiting cells below. The gallery was almost immediately cleared, and amongst the many men and women who had filled the seats in huge numbers was the mother of Willen, who had been screaming and uttering wild cries of despair as sentence was being passed down. On Monday, 23rd of May, Mr. W.F. Alderson, solicitor, was instructed by the Friends of Willen to prepare a petition for the presentation to the Home Secretary, asking him for a commutation of the death sentence. Interestingly, Willen was entered into the official jail records as a Roman Catholic, and before his trial he had been visited by the Reverend Father Timoney of St. Albans Ancourt, and it was believed that he had supported the petition and that copies of it would be available to be signed in the Ancourt and Oldham and Rochdale Road districts. On Saturday, 29th of May, four girls, Jane Carroll, Ellen Fox, Mary Ann Mack and Hannah Horbin, were charged at Manchester Police Court with being engaged in a scuttling affray. At around 10:30 p.m. on Friday, Police Constable Wildburn saw the prisoners accosting and behaving in a disorderly manner in Dickinson Street. He made every effort to arrest them, but they managed to escape. However, at around 1:30 a.m. on the Saturday morning, he again saw the women on the corner of Chepstow Street and Oxford Street. Horbin, who was connected with William, was drunk and had a belt in her possession. And on one of her arms were tattooed the words, "In loving remembrance of William Willen." She had arrived in Manchester after being an inmate at Elizabeth School over in Liverpool until her 16th birthday. Now, Inspector Buckley declared that the girls were often the most violent participants in street fights, and after only a few minutes' deliberations, all four girls, of whom were well known to the police, were sentenced to a month's imprisonment with hard labour. Just over a week later, and on Wednesday the 1st of June, Mr. Alderson received a letter in reference to the case of Willen. "Sir, in reply to your letter on the 30th instant, forwarding a numerously signed memorial in reference to the case of William Willen, who was convicted of murder at the Manchester Assizes on the 20th instant and sentenced to death, I am directed by the Secretary of State to inform you that, after consultation with the learned judge, he had felt justified in advising Her Majesty to commute the capital sentence or passed upon the prisoner to one of light penal servitude. I am, sir, your obedient servant, E. Lee Pemberton." In effect, Willen would escape from the hangman's noose and be ordered to serve penal servitude for life, but this wouldn't be the end of his story. In fact, Willen would only serve 8 years imprisonment and was released from Strangeways prison in 1900. Upon his release at the age of 24, he returned to normal life working as a cooper, living alone in nearby Harper Hay. Now, whilst this may not seem as strange as first appears, what makes his story even more intriguing is that whilst he was facing the possibility of execution, a letter written by the Governor of Strangeways on behalf of Willen was sent to Inspector Jerome Caminada, one of Manchester's finest detectives at the time, and it would prove to be a life-changing experience for Willen and that of Caminada. Whilst not directly involved with the case, Caminada was curious as to why Willen would want to speak to him. What Caminada experienced on the day of his visit to Strangeways would leave a long-lasting memory. "The poor lad put his arms through the bars which separate us, and with tears streaming down his cheeks, implored me to save him. I was much affected, and I promised I would do all in my power towards this end." Jerome Caminada, 1892. Willen, who had not only had the help of the Reverend Father Timoney, who was trying his hardest to help, now had one of the Victorian's most respected police inspectors alongside him. And in what we may say is a twist of fate, Willen would, 5 years after his release from prison, go on to marry the daughter of Caminada, Florence May, on the 22nd of March 1905. The following year, Florence would give birth to their son George William Louis on the 15th of June. William Willen would go on to lead a normal life, owning a fish and chip shop that wasn't too far away from the spot which saw him take the life of Peter Kennedy after the brutal attack back on that fateful afternoon on Saturday, 23rd of April, 1892. He lived until the age of 75 when he passed away in 1951, and he was laid to rest at Phillips Park Cemetery, Manchester. And even though we may look at the story of William Willen and realise that whilst he would become a changed character who went on to lead a relatively normal life after his release from prison, we should never forget about the other young boy in this story who is also laid to rest in Phillips Park Cemetery. Peter Kennedy was a victim of the times, a member of a rival Scotland gang, and someone tough enough to, for most parts, stand up for himself. And yet he was struck down in his youth at the hands of a boy of the same age. He would never get the opportunity to grow old, live a happy life, or have children of his own. His grave can be found by looking for his headstone that is located within the Roman Catholic plot and is recorded as being H617. As for the beginning of the end of the Scuttlers, what truly makes this case stand out amongst the relatively few fights between the rival gangs that had resulted in murder was that it seemed gang members would try not to defend William for his actions. While Scuttling was a menace to society, there was still a bizarre code of honour that most of the gangs seemingly adhered to. Whilst they would fight each other using any available objects they could lay their hands on, from broken pot bottles to belts and stones, one thing that very rarely happened was that one of their own would be intentionally murdered by another rival gang. And whilst death did occur from the effects of the odd fight, the William Willen case, it seems, shocked the gangs of Manchester to the very core, resulting in them turning on one of their own for the very first time. The days of Scuttling were coming to an end. So many, many thanks for listening to this story. This is the first episode of season 3. If you did like it, please leave a comment down below. We will be doing some more stories on the gangs of Manchester and the Scuttling era. Again, if you do like these kind of stories, stick with us because more and more will be coming in 2022. But in the meantime, guys, many thanks for listening. And like I always say, take care, look after yourselves, and we will be back soon with another tale from our past.